Yeah, so good morning. This is the case of State versus Bartle. And we will begin by having members of the court introduce themselves, and then counsel will have you introduce yourselves. But I am Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and by seniority as to time on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Justice Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Stephanie Stacy.
Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik.
John Frydenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. And Mr. Wilson, you don't have to start arguing now, but please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mike Wilson on behalf of the appellant, Mark Bartle.
And Mr. Liss, would you introduce yourself?
Good morning, Your Honor. Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska.
Counsel, before we begin, do either of you have any questions?
No, Your Honor.
No.
Very good. Thank you very much. We will commence then. Both of you have 10 minutes per side. And Mr. Wilson, good morning again, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel for the state. Again, I'm Mike Wilson, and I represent the appellant, Mark Bartle, in this appeal. Mr. Bartle has raised three assignments of error. This morning, I intend to focus on the first of those assignments of error, and that relates to our contention that the that we've introduced as by way of a motion for new trial, new evidence that necessitates the granting of a new trial in the county court on the charge of violation of a domestic violence protection order. So the first thing that I'll point out is that Exhibit 201 contains an order from the Douglas County District Court, specifically the judge who entered a protection order Mr. Bartle was found guilty of violating that order. And then following a trial and a sentencing, Mr. Bartle began a direct appeal, and then he ended up dismissing that direct appeal and filing a motion for new trial, the hearing on that, he submitted Exhibit 201. And in that exhibit, you have an order of the district court rendering the protection order that was the impetus for the prosecution in this case, rendering it void ab initio. And that is the exact language taken.
Mr. Wilson, what authority did that judge have to issue an order stating that its original protection order was void ab initio?
Thank you, Your Honor. That's a good question. So if you go to Nebraska Revised Statute Section 25-2001, subsection 4, under that particular statute, a district court does have the authority to vacate or modify its own judgments or orders, even after the term in which they're issued, quote, for fraud that's practiced by the successful party in obtaining the judgment or order. Now, I understand that the Exhibit 201 is a stipulated order, and that MB, I'll refer to her as MB, the party who was successful in obtaining that protection order, stipulated that that order was void ab initio. There's no other grounds listed in Exhibit 201 for her stipulation to that fact, to that finding, that it's void ab initio. So when we look at the case law and we look at, I mean, and this is case law of Nebraska and just about everywhere else, when an order is found void ab initio, there's two grounds generally that could be resting on, and that's either a lack of jurisdiction by the issuing court or fraud. Now, the state's argued that that's not, that I believe, and I'll let the state make its own arguments, obviously, but, and I hope I'm not mischaracterizing, but my understanding of the state's argument is that since Exhibit 201 does not necessarily, it doesn't include, they pointed out that Exhibit 201 doesn't include language specifically stating that there was a fraud or lack of jurisdiction on the part of the issuing court here of the protection order. My point would be that there's really no other implication that can be taken from Exhibit 201. So, you know, to the extent that the standard here is a reasonable probability of a different outcome at trial.
What does Exhibit 201 on its face or anything else in our record tell us about why Exhibit 201 was entered? Do we have any idea why the district court judge decided to purport to void its prior protection order?
So I think so, Your Honor, and thank you for asking that. I think what you look at is the intent of the parties that is reflected in Exhibit 201 is that Mr. Bart, my client's conviction for the violation of the protection order, their intent was to have, was that that conviction be found void, vacated. And that, that is the evidence of the party's intent in that order. Now, the
if I may, is 201 merely evidence or is it proof of an element in the current case?
In the is it proof of an element of the violation of protection order offense? Is that the question, Your Honor?
Right. It's an exhibit. It's a piece of evidence. What does it stand for in terms of persuasion? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The what we've pointed out in our briefing, Your Honor, is that, well, number one, it suggests that there that the conviction is contrary to law. In other words, if you, you know, understanding what the phrase void ab initio means, it means that the order never should have existed. It was null from in, from the outset. So we'd argue that it's newly discovered evidence of a verdict that's contrary to law. Number one. Number two, if you're speaking specifically about the elements of violation of a domestic violence protection order, one of them would be that a valid protection order was entered. And so we'd argue that that element is directly directly disproven by a stipulation of the party who obtained the domestic violence protection order, that she either pursued or obtained that protection order without either jurisdiction or by perpetrating a fraud upon the district court. So for those reasons, I believe that that goes to the element of whether a valid protection order was ever entered in the first place.
Counsel, other than this case, have we ever sanctioned a situation where parties stipulate and agree that a judgment should be found void ab initio? What weight do we give the party's agreement to that effect? And isn't that a particularly dangerous thing to do in a situation involving alleged domestic abuse?
I understand Your Honor's concerns. And so what I think we have to look to, first of all, to answer your question, Your Honor, I couldn't find case law specifically on point here. I think what the state and I have both zeroed in on really is the most, you know, on point case regarding evidence that becomes available, and they call it newly available evidence in the case of State v. Jackson. That's 264 Nebraska 420, a 2002 case. There are policy considerations that are discussed in that case. And what I'd argue here is that we have some key differences that I think address those policy concerns. And really the policy concerns in Jackson revolved around whether we want co-defendants who, once they feel safe from any sort of trial or retrial, essentially taking blame for the offense that the defendant's accused of.
Mr. Wilson,
yes.
Here, in the past, we've talked about newly discovered evidence. We've talked about newly available evidence. But isn't what we have here newly created evidence? And how does that factor into our case law?
I understand what you're asking, Your Honor. And I think it does. I believe you're probably asking that question because I brought up Jackson, and it is kind of an evolution from what you see in Jackson, correct? So I don't necessarily think it's newly created evidence, because what we have there then is a chicken or egg problem, because what we have here is an order that's stipulated to by a licensed attorney, I will point out, and that is in my brief as well. I wanted to point out that the party here, the alleged victim of the, you know, who testified in the prosecution, was a licensed attorney. She understood what she was doing, and she said that this order never should have been admitted. So yes, the order itself was newly created, but the effect, legally speaking, was one that eviscerated the entire basis for the conviction in the first place, and actually has the legal effect of removing that the basis of for that element. So yes, while the order itself is dated post-conviction, the effect, the legal effect, is much more far-reaching.
At the time of the trial in this matter, there was a valid protection order there. I understand you're saying the subsequent actions invalidate it, but at the time of the trial, it existed, correct? And I'm not taking away your argument saying in retroactive application. At the time, it existed, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not going to argue that point with you.
And your client was aware that he was not supposed to be there, correct? Pursuant to that order.
He was allowed to be there for purposes of picking up his children. There was an exception in the Domestic Violence Protection Order allowing him to have contact for purposes of visits and that sort of thing.
But it had very specific language where and when, and this was outside that specific language, correct?
Your Honor, that was the state's position at trial, was that his contact went beyond the exceptions that were provided in the Domestic Violence Protection Order, correct?
Okay.
I don't have any further time, Your Honor, so thank you very much.
Mr. Wilson, I'm going to ask you one more question. I'm going to read a quote that we have used in regard to civil cases in newly discovered evidence, and I realize this is a criminal case, but I want you to respond as to whether or not this might be helpful to us in this case. The quote is, evidence of facts happening after trial ordinarily cannot be considered as newly discovered evidence on which to justify the granting of a new trial. A new trial will not be granted on the ground of newly discovered evidence where it appears that such evidence was not available at the time of the trial, but rather the result of changed conditions since.
Understood. So if the way I'd respond to that's twofold, Your Honor. Number one, I'd argue that when you're talking about a criminal conviction, we have due process concerns that extend beyond those that you see in civil cases, and I don't need to belabor the details of that. The court's, you know, well aware of the differences between the criminal and civil arenas. With respect, though, assuming we take that proposition of law and apply it straight to a criminal case, I take issue with characterizing this solely as evidence of facts occurring. As a fact, Exhibit 201 is a fact occurring post-trial. I consider Exhibit 201 to have retroactive effect, rendering this conviction contrary to law. And I understand the court's concerns regarding, modifying or allowing a new trial in a criminal matter after the conviction's entered. But in this scenario, at a minimum, Mr. Bartel should receive an opportunity to expose a fact that's been admitted to essentially by the alleged victim, again, not a co-defendant, but an alleged victim, that renders the entire prosecution null and void because of the, you know, the legal impact of the finding of void ab initio. If there had been any other kind of finding in this stipulation, I think my argument would be much more of a stretch. But because of that what the definition of the phrase void ab initio and the sophistication of the parties the party entering into this, particularly MB, that I'd argue is different than what we're talking about in the civil context.
I would like to ask another question with the chief's permission.
You may, Justice Miller-Lerman.
Thank you. Are you aware of federal cases dealing with felon in possession resulting in conviction and thereafter the underlying felony is the conviction for the underlying felony is reversed and what the courts do?
Your Honor, that's a good question. And I am not aware exactly how that's been treated in the federal courts. My thought is that perhaps what's happened in some of those cases, based on you asking me this question, is that they leave those felon in possession convictions undisturbed. Am I correct in that assumption?
I asked the question.
All right. I thought I'd try. So, you know, if that is the case, that those convictions were left undisturbed, you know, I'd suggest that the reasoning does not translate well to this situation. And the reason being that at some point, those convictions that served as the predicate for the felon in possession conviction, those were valid convictions. However, in this case, we have a legal finding that's different. We have a legal finding that the protection order was never valid. And so because that's the legal finding of the district court, that puts us in a position where the jury should have been made aware that there was never actually a legally entered protection order. That I think that's how I would best distinguish it, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Mr. List, then, good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Good morning again, Your Honors. Again, for the record, Nathan List, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appellee of the State of Nebraska. Bartlett assigned three errors with respect to the denial of his motion for a new trial. As noted in our brief, the second and third assignments of error are not properly before this court, given that they are premised on claims that were untimely and invalid grounds for a new trial, given that the motion was filed more than 10 days after the verdict was rendered. Only the first assignment of error, which is premised on a claim of newly discovered evidence, is properly before this court. So, like Mr. Wilson, I will also focus only on that claim. As far as that newly discovered evidence claim, we maintain that a new trial was not warranted on that claim because Judge Reddlesdorf's order in the separate protection order case does not qualify as newly discovered evidence for purposes of this case. First and foremost, as set forth in our brief, we agree with Judge Polk's order in this case to the extent that it questions whether or not Judge Reddlesdorf even had authority to vacate that protection order after it had expired. Under sections 42-924 and 925 of the Domestic Abuse Act, protection orders are to remain in effect for a period of 1 year unless that order is dismissed or modified prior to such date. Here, however, Judge Reddlesdorf's order purporting to vacate that protection order was entered more than 8 months after the protection order had already expired. So we agree with Judge Polk's assertion that it appears there was no authority to even vacate that protection order in the first place. As far as the appellant's reliance on Section 25-2001, subsection 4, we would submit that statute is unavailing for the appellant. First, the provision they're attempting to rely on there is the premise of fraud. With respect to that theory, there of course is no evidence in this case of fraud. There have been no findings to that effect, so we would submit that theory It simply doesn't apply. But additionally, I would point out that under Section 25-2001, in order to modify a judgment on that basis, as I understand that statute and the law interpreting it, you need to move for that modification within 6 months of the judgment being entered. That didn't happen here either. The order entering or modifying, purporting to patent, vacate the protection order in this case, didn't occur until 18 months after it was entered. So we see no basis under the Domestic Abuse Act or under 25-2001 to go in and modify or in any way vacate the protection order after it had long expired. Just briefly, as far as your question, Justice Stacey, about authority of the parties to stipulate to something of this nature, I don't have a particular case law in front of me, but I do recall reading case law in the past that discusses the fact that parties only have authority to stipulate to facts, not to the law. With respect to this particular issue, we would submit that this really is just a legal question and nothing more. A determination that something's void ab initio is not something the parties, it's not a factual matter that they can simply stipulate to. That's a legal determination for a court to make and only for a court to make. So we don't believe that a stipulation would provide the necessary authority for that determination either. Simply put, we would submit there was no authority to even vacate the protection order. But in any event, even if there was authority to enter an order vacating that protection order in the separate protection order case, we would submit that it still does not constitute newly discovered evidence for purposes of this case for two reasons. Number one, it was not newly discovered. As Justice Castle was just pointing out, this order in the protection order case was newly created and newly available, which is distinct from newly discovered. And our case law is clear that evidence which is merely newly available is not a sufficient basis for a new trial. And number two, Judge Rosenthal's order in the protection order case has no bearing on Bartle's criminal conviction in this case. Her order does purport to affect this case by declaring the protection order void ab initio, but we would submit that there is no basis for that declaration or that notion. The protection order was validly entered. It was valid and in effect at the time Mr. Bartle violated it, and it was valid and in effect through the entirety of Mr. Bartle's criminal prosecution. It clearly was not void ab initio. So to the extent that Judge Rosenthal's order declared to be voided ab initio, we would submit that that was invalid and has no retroactive effect on this case, assuming there was even authority in the first place to enter that order vacating a protection order. As far as the appellant's assertion that the protection order was void ab initio due to the alleged fraud of the victim in this case, we adamantly disagree. There's absolutely no evidence of fraud by the victim in this case, expressed or implied. And Judge Rosenthal's order makes no mention or any findings of fraud by the victim in this case. So the allegation of fraud is entirely unfounded, and we disagree with the appellant's assertion that the protection order is void ab initio on that basis. And again, we see no other basis to conclude that it's void ab initio. In sum, we maintain that Judge Rosenthal's order in the protection order case was either unauthorized altogether, or to the extent that it was authorized to some extent, it still does not render the protection order void ab initio. Either way, we would submit that it is not newly discovered evidence for purposes of this case and does not warrant a new trial. And we would therefore submit that Bartle's motion for new trial is properly denied. If there are no questions from the court, we would request that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Mr. Liss, I have a question. It seems that perhaps the facts in this case point to an error by a judge who is not in this case. How is the, if we were to write an opinion agreeing with your analysis of the case, that there the judges who actually handled this case should be affirmed, how do we overrule, so to speak, a judge that was not in this case?
Well, I don't know if you really have to go that far, as far as anything would affect that other case. I think it's only your analysis is taking place in the context of the motion for new trial that was filed in this case, and you're responding to the appellant's assertion that this newly discovered evidence warrants relief. And our response is no, that it doesn't, because the order upon which they're relying from the separate protection order case is either, you know, unauthorized altogether, or to the extent it is authorized, it doesn't render the protection order void ab initio and doesn't amount to newly discovered evidence warranting relief in this case. So I don't know that you need to do anything that purportedly affects anything in the protection order case. You're simply addressing what happened in that case to the extent that it has been brought into this case and is being alleged as a basis for relief.
So we're still reviewing the discretionary decision by the trial court. That's where we should focus our opinion upon.
Right. Well, technically we're reviewing the district court that affirmed the county court's denial of the motion for new trial, but ultimately, yes, we are viewing this for an abuse of discretion, whether or not the county court abuses discretion by denying that motion for new trial. And that is the standard since an evidentiary hearing was held under State v. Cross. If an evidentiary hearing had not been held, we'd be under a de novo standard of review, but one was held. So we'd be under an abuse of discretion standard. And in reviewing the district court's judgment, we would submit that there was no error in finding that the county court did not abuse its discretion by denying the motion for new trial.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I do not believe we have time for rebuttal. Is that correct? Right. We have no time for rebuttal. So that concludes arguments in State versus Bartell. Counsel, both of you, we want to thank you for participating by WebEx. The court will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Johnson. Counsel, you are excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.